The men on the moon were glad to hear his voice, and a brief chat ensued. Duke talked about the previous night, when he had lain awake, overcome by excitement and anticipation, while Young sawed wood.
Couldn't believe we'd go to sleep, Deke, but man, this guy John sleeps like a baby up here.
It sounds like the best place in the world to sleep, Slayton said simply. I wish I was with you.
Young answered,
We do too, boss.
2. You just bit off more than you can chew. Saturday, April 22nd, Manned Spacecraft Center. It had been a long night for Mark Langseth and his heat flow experiment. Shortly after the first moonwalk was finished, a task force had convened in a back room, including engineers from the Bendix Corporation, who built the experiment, Fred Hayes, Apollo 16's backup commander, and a couple of people from the Tiger Team, the squad of ever-ready engineers who were called into service to solve the knottiest hardware problems. Langseth was amazed by them. They soaked up information. They were inexhaustible. They were so confident that Langseth felt they could have surmounted any failure. The Tiger Team brought a 5-gallon jug of ice cream and went to work. The cause of the accident became clear once the Bendix people described the connector that had attached the heat flow cable to the central station. Originally, it had been hardwired, but at a late date, Bendix changed the design to a connector. Langseth never saw the connector they used, but now they told him that it had a sharp edge. The cable had probably broken because the connector had sheared it in two. Langseth wasn't angry at John Young. He was furious at Bendix. But how to recover? The cable could be reinserted into the connector, but first the astronauts must have a way to strip off its insulation to expose the wires. What was needed was an abrasive of some kind, and it just so happened that a very good one was available, lunar rock. By morning, and many scoops of ice cream later, the team had come up with a plan. Young and Duke would bring the cable and the still-attached heat flow electronics box into the lunar module at the end of the second moonwalk. Inside the lander, they would wrap the end of the cable around the handle of the geology hammer and scrape off the insulation with a rock. Finally, they would cut a clean edge with the scissors. On the third moonwalk, they would reconnect the experiment to the central station. Fred Hayes tested the procedure. It worked. Around 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, Langseth and the team went to the VIP room at the back of Mission Control to make their case to Chris Kraft and Rocco Petroni. A few other ALSEP scientists went along for moral support. No one needed to say that the astronauts would go along with the plan. Fixing things was part of their being. And Langseth pointed out that a repair would demonstrate the value of having humans in space instead of machines, a point he hoped would play better than, I want my experiment fixed. Kraft and Petroni listened, and they allowed as how it might work, but it was hardly a sure thing. There were 48 separate wires in that cable that had to make contact, and no one could guarantee the procedure would work on the moon. And even if it did work, it would cost a lot of time. The team estimated a total of an hour during the two moonwalks, plus another hour for the work inside Orion. Petroni said, We're not going to do it. Langseth would say later that he did not question the decision. The astronauts' time was too precious to spend on fixing one experiment. They had the moon to contend with. 12:03 p.m. Houston time. 6 days, 0 hours, 9 minutes mission elapsed time, Descartes Highlands. In one way, Stone Mountain was just like Hadley Delta. It was steeper than either Young or Duke had realized on the way up. Young parked the rover in a small, subdued crater so that it wouldn't start sliding down the hill the way Scott and Irwin's had. When he turned to look back to the north, he saw the mountain drop away from him in a series of steep-sided ridges. Off to the west, it looked really treacherous, even more steep than the slope they had driven up. Young said to himself, You've just nearly bit off more than you can chew. But the view from this high vantage, like the one that had confronted Scott and Irwin, was dazzling. They were 500 feet above the valley floor, higher than any Apollo moonwalkers ever had been or would be again. And the most spectacular sight was South Ray Crater, 5 times the size of a football field, its rim an absolutely brilliant white, seemingly as fresh as the day it was blasted out of the Cayley Plains. Rays of boulders, black boulders, white boulders, were sprayed across the landscape for miles in all directions. The boulders next to the rim looked to be 90 feet across. South Ray was a beautiful excavation into the Cayley, and Young had pushed hard to go there on one of the moonwalks, even to add a 4th excursion for the purpose if necessary. But astronomers had made soundings with radar beams from Earth, and when they analyzed the echoes from South Ray crater, they determined there would be too many rocks for a rover to gain safe passage. Now Young could see that they had overestimated the hazard. Still, on the way up here, he and Duke had driven across a rise with so many boulders that he feared one of them would break a wheel assembly off the rover. Perhaps getting to South Ray would have been tough, but he felt sure they could have made it to its nearby, smaller counterpart, Baby Ray. Under his excitement, Young felt the frustration of discoveries beyond his reach. But if they could not visit South Ray, its rocky artillery fire was scattered across the southwestern face of Stone Mountain. Those rocks, clean and sharp-edged, set Stone apart from the bland slopes of Hadley Delta. And if the rocks really were South Ray ejecta, as Young suspected, then even though they were 500 feet up on Stone Mountain, they were picking up pieces of the Cayley Plains. "You know, John," said Duke, "with all these rocks here, I'm not sure we're getting Descartes." "That's right, I'm not either." When these words reached the back room, they only confirmed what Mulberger and his team had anticipated before the mission. Realizing that Young and Duke might find South Ray ejecta here, they'd chosen 5 craters, deep enough to have penetrated bedrock, for Young and Duke to visit. They were named the Cincos. If Young and Duke could get to one of the Cincos, they would probably find large boulders whose source could be confidently tied to the mountain. Young and Duke had been looking for the Cincos on the drive up, but they were never sure where they were. Ironically, the largest of the 5, Cinco A, was only 40 yards from the place where they stopped. Young and Duke would never realize that it was just out of view behind a ridge. There weren't any large boulders here, but Young wasn't giving up. "Okay, Houston, I'm digging an exploratory trench." According to the geologist's theory, the mountain could have formed from sticky lavas that oozed to the surface and congealed, or cinders that flowed across the landscape and then solidified. The rocks Young plucked from the trench were covered with dust, but as far as he could tell, they looked just like what he had seen down on the Cayley Plains. "I wish I could say these rocks look different, Houston, but they don't." Now Tony England sent word from the back room to look for another crater within walking distance that might yield samples of Descartes. Young made his way about 50 yards up the slope to a 60-foot-wide, block-strewn bowl. When he reached the rim, he realized these rocks, too, were invaders from South Ray. Young had another idea that showed his insight. He decided to rake the side of the crater facing away from South Ray, the side that would have been shadowed from the barrage of ejecta. Like a prospector panning for gold, Young stood on the crater's soft, powdery wall and hacked away with the rake, struggling to hold the tool with tired, aching hands. His difficult harvest was not what he expected. What looked like rocks turned out to be clods of dirt that fell apart in the sample bag. Years later, Young would say that when you are on the moon, inside a pressurized spacesuit with only 6 or 7 hours outside and no more than an hour at any given place, you just can't take time to try and see the big picture. You're supposed to be getting the samples and documenting them according to the timeline. If you try to be anything more than a technician, you are doing a disservice to the scientists who sent you. There was no anxiety on Stone Mountain now, as Young and Duke came bounding down the hillside, laughing as they returned to the rover. The tension was in the back room, where Mulberger and his team knew they had one chance left to snare samples of the Descartes on Stone Mountain. 1:04 p.m. After a nervous drive downslope, Young parked next to a 50-foot crater that seemed to be free of South Ray ejecta. Young again suggested that he and Duke work the slope that faced away from South Ray. After some effort, the men felt as though they were on the verge of tumbling into the crater. They culled from the crater wall some small, whitish rocks that were not jagged like South Ray ejecta, but rounded. To Young, that meant they were older, having been eroded by micrometeorite rain. But even these were not clearly pieces of Descartes. He told Tony England, "I don't think this is going to be a simple problem even after you get the rocks back." But when the men climbed out of the crater and headed back to the rover, they got the biggest surprise of the day. Young almost tripped over it. A shoe-sized white rock sparkled in the sunlight.
"We're going to get that one," said Young excitedly. "That's the first one I've seen here that I really believe is a crystalline rock."
It seemed to be made entirely of plagioclase, much like the Genesis rock, but with crystals that were tiny, like sugar. Like the Genesis rock, it could be a surviving fragment of anorthosite from the primordial crust, but it had clearly been kicked around by eons of meteorite impacts. But it surely was not volcanic, and as Young and Duke headed down from Stone Mountain, it seemed that on this mission there would be no moments of clear discovery like the one that had heralded the Genesis rock. No excited announcements from the moon, "We found what we came for." Instead, Young and Duke had found what was there. And in the back room, Mulberger and his team felt it had been a good day. Young's ingenuity had greatly impressed them. Whatever the Descartes was made of, they knew Young and Duke had probably succeeded in collecting representative samples. The true nature of the Cayley and the Descartes was unfolding word by word, rock by rock. 3. Or wherever geologists go. No one who knew Ken Mattingly would accuse him of being a patient man, but in the last 2 years he had sorely needed patience, and even more, raw persistence. After getting bumped from Apollo 13 a week before launch, Mattingly dove into 2 more years of training, with no let-up, for Apollo 16. Then, with just 2 weeks to go, the NASA doctors told him they'd found an irregular reading in one of his blood tests. He had an elevated level of bilirubin, an indicator of liver function. Physically, he felt fine. In fact, he was in superb condition, but as far as he could tell, the doctors were suggesting he might be coming down with hepatitis. Surely they understood that this was an impending disaster, and yet they offered him no advice on how to avert it. They just kept taking blood tests, waiting to see what would happen. For 3 or 4 miserable days, Mattingly feared another medical false alarm was going to steal his last chance to go to the moon. Then the doctors decided he was fine. Needless to say, it had all been worth it. The past 7 days had been the climax of his career, and even aside from the flying, he had been living through one unforgettable sight after another. It got so he didn't want to look at each new spectacular for fear of erasing the memories of what had come before. Then, after the trauma of the wave-off, he was finally ready to carry out his solo mission. He knew the moon so well that he didn't even need to look at a map. It had been Mattingly who had been first to sign on with Farouk Elbaz. But even now, after working with the man for almost 3 years, and he liked Elbaz a great deal, he could not honestly say that he was interested in geology or in the moon, and he had told Elbaz that up front. But he was ready to do whatever Elbaz asked, not just because he admired him, but because he wanted to be something more than a truck driver. He wanted to make a contribution. Hell, he wanted something to do. But what was he going to contribute? Would he really be able to see anything with his own eyes that wasn't already in the thousands of lunar orbiter pictures or the Apollo photos? Oh, Farouk told him that there was no substitute for the human observer. But he wasn't unbiased, was he? After all, if there were no need for the human observer, then NASA wouldn't need Farouk. But now, with 3 days in lunar orbit under his belt, he had to admit he could see more than he'd ever expected. What had looked like a pile of whitish rubble was now brimming with details. He found himself staying awake well past the start of his sleep periods because he didn't want to miss anything. Whatever the Cayley formation was made of, there was more of it all over the far side of the moon. To Mattingly, the bright, smooth highland plains didn't look volcanic. They seemed to consist of debris that had been shaken, like a bowl full of gravel until the surface was relatively flat. He would tell the geologists all of this when he was back home. Still, Mattingly knew, you can't analyze the dimensions, or the brightness, or the color of an impression. The real data would be the pictures. Cameras don't make mistakes. He couldn't say the same for himself. Sunday, April 23rd, 10:39 a.m., Houston time. 6 days, 22 hours, 45 minutes mission elapsed time. Inside Casper, in the pitch blackness of an orbital night, Ken Mattingly heard his own voice on tape break the stillness. In 20 seconds, the DAC will go on and remain on until sunrise. Adjust the settings. Outside, the depths of space were crossed by fingers of light, streamers of the sun's outer atmosphere. It is this envelope of dimly glowing gas, the corona, that frames the moon's silhouette during a total solar eclipse on Earth. For a glimpse of its cold, eerie light, astronomers will travel halfway around the world, but Mattingly now saw the corona as only the space traveler could in the last minutes of orbital night, while the sun still hid below the unseen horizon. It was Mattingly's task to capture the corona on film using the Data Acquisition Camera, DAC, and the tape. That was a matter of efficiency. Mattingly knew the inside of the command module so well that even in pitch darkness he could find his way around, and he knew that if he flicked on a flashlight to glance at a checklist, even for a moment, he'd ruin his night vision. So he'd spent an hour during the trip out to the moon reading his checklist into the portable tape recorder. Stand by for the start. 4, 3, 2, 1. Start. Mattingly activated the camera and heard the steady click of advancing film. Data. That's what it was all about. Slowly, the luminous coronal streamers brightened, and then pitch darkness yielded to blinding sunlight. And now came the best time of all. Even though he would have traded places with Young and Duke in an instant, he could not imagine how bounding across the surface of the moon was more fun than orbiting it alone. Charlie Duke liked country music, and he'd brought along a tape of Grand Ole Opry stars from the same guy who'd supplied Pete Conrad and Stu Rusa. He played it all the way out to the moon. Mattingly almost got to like country. Almost. But now, with Casper to himself, Mattingly savored the music he loved. In Houston, they could hear snatches of it in the background whenever he keyed his mic. A Mahler symphony, Holst's The Planets, and Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. It didn't sound as good as Riding Old Paint, teased Stu Rusa, but I guess it'll do. And here, over the far side, it was the perfect background music to the silent, unreal panorama that filled the windows. He went about his work in a carefully orchestrated, weightless ballet, tending the scientific instruments, taking pictures, and turning his eyes moonward in search of a new discovery for Farouk Elbaz. And there's old Mother Earth, Mattingly said aloud. Man, that's a beauty, too. Never get tired of watching Earth rise. Earth, the source of all his troubles. To no one's surprise, Mattingly had put together a staggering solo flight plan and was bent on doing it all. He wouldn't waste time checking the mission clock for the timing of his tasks. Instead, whenever he was in radio contact, he would let the Capcom watch the systems and the clock for him, leaving him free to concentrate on the moon. When Houston needed him to turn an experiment on or change a switch setting, he was a happy robot. And if they'd only left him alone, he would have been glad to continue that way for another 2 days. But the engine problem, and then Young and Duke's late landing, seemed to have thrown all of mission control into a tailspin. For some reason, he still wasn't sure why, they were going to cut an entire day off the mission. One of the 2 days the three men had planned to spend studying the moon after the surface work was finished. That alone wreaked havoc on Mattingly's flight plan. He'd specifically talked to the flight directors before the mission, and they'd agreed that if something unexpected should interfere with the schedule, they wouldn't try to reschedule everything. They'd just lop off the parts that were affected. But the flight directors seemed to have forgotten all about that. Every time he turned around, there was another revision to copy down. Even more frustrating, the flight planners were sending him procedures that hadn't been tested. They hadn't had time to check their own work. It was as if they'd never flown a mission before. They were ruining his ballet. He wanted to get on the radio and say, "All right, you guys, knock it off." Instead, he called up every ounce of self-restraint and kept his irritation to himself. Even when he was out of their reach, over the far side, he fell prey to the same problem that had plagued his predecessors, too much to do. Before the flight, without even realizing it, he'd let extra tasks creep into the time reserved for eating, and he didn't realize what that would be like until now. As it was, just about the only time he managed to eat was when he had to stop to go to the bathroom. There he was, slurping down a plastic bag of juice while hooked up to the urine collection hose, with a fecal collection bag flypapered to his rear end. Not the image of the intrepid lunar explorer. Mattingly always wanted to be the first man to go to Mars. If that trip was going to be anything like Apollo, he'd tell them to forget it. Sunday, April 23rd, on the Cayley Plains. Like most astronauts, Charlie Duke would tell you that he rarely dreams at night and remembers his dreams even less often. But Duke had a dream, 6 months before the flight, that he had no trouble remembering. In Hawaii, on a geology trip, Duke came down with the flu and ran a high fever. At times he was almost delirious. Some of the wives had come along, and Duke's wife, Dottie, took care of him while his colleagues were out in the field. In a fever sleep, Duke saw himself and John Young on the moon, driving their rover toward North Ray Crater. They came up over a ridge, and suddenly Duke spotted something that made his heart race. A set of tracks crossed the ground ahead. Young stopped the rover, and they got off to investigate. The imprints in the dust looked like those from the rover, but they were definitely different. Duke asked Mission Control, "Can we follow the tracks?" "Go ahead," was the reply from Earth. The twin trails stretched eastward, and Young and Duke turned to follow them. They drove onward for miles, over hills and across craters, until finally, topping another rise, they saw it. A vehicle, looking amazingly like the rover, stopped on the surface. Aboard were two figures in spacesuits. After calling Houston to announce their incredible discovery, Young and Duke climbed off the rover and approached the two figures, motionless in their seats. When Duke reached the one in the right seat, he could not see into its helmet because of its opaque sun visor. He put out his hand and raised the visor and saw his own face. The one in the left seat was John Young's double. After taking pieces of the spacesuits and rover at Mission Control's request, Young and Duke drove back to the LM and blasted off for home. The next thing Duke knew, he was on Earth, presenting the samples to the scientists. The test results. The craft was 100,000 years old. Then he woke up. The dream was so vivid, not scary, just real, that Duke remembered it from then on, and as he descended to the real moon inside Orion, he glanced out to his right at North Ray Crater and scanned the ground, not only for boulders. "Looks like we're going to make it, John. There's not too many blocks up there," but for a set of tracks. 10:32 a.m., Science Operations Room. Consider the athletic standing of the Caltech football team, low, and understand that Bill Mulberger had seen his share of tough games. By any objective measure, Apollo 16 had turned out to be one of them. In the contest between the geologists and the moon clearly had the upper hand. Yesterday, Mulberger had ruefully realized that the astronomers' radar soundings of South Ray Crater, so promising for samples from deep within the Cayley, had misled them all into thinking it was inaccessible. And today the clock was running out on their chances to find volcanic rocks in the Descartes Highlands. The managers had trimmed Apollo 16's final moonwalk to only 5 hours. No extensions, lest they violate the liftoff time, leaving just enough time for a dash to North Ray Crater, some 3 miles north of the lunar module. North Ray Crater was a prime destination for many reasons. For one thing, no astronauts had yet reached the rim of a large, well-preserved crater to hunt for samples of deep bedrock. North Ray certainly fit the bill. Not only was it fresh, but it was more than 6/10 of a mile across, nearly as big as Arizona's Meteor Crater, and more than 650 feet deep. North Ray was big enough to have punched through any surface layer of soil and debris into the underlying Descartes rocks at the base of Smoky Mountain. The explosive impact that formed it had sprinkled boulders across the landscape like grains of sand. The ones on North Ray's rim might have come from hundreds of feet down, and some of them were so big that they showed up on the photo maps. Young and Duke had already spotted a few of those boulders during the drive up. As he waited for them to reach the crater, Mulberger was not grim. If his team had known a little confusion in the past 2 days, then their two surrogates on the moon had more than made up for that with their skill and insight. Mulberger was proud of them. 10:37 a.m.
Oh, spectacular, just spectacular!
Young's excited voice filled the back room. He and Duke had reached the crater. Soon a TV picture appeared on the monitors, but Young and Duke weren't in it. Ed Fendel, the engineer who operated the rover's camera from his seat in mission control, had aimed it at a blue and white crescent in a black sky.
"Come on, camera," Mulberger said impatiently. "Quit looking at the Earth, goddammit!"
At last the camera panned down to the side of two tiny space-suited figures standing before a gigantic pit, which was so big that it extended well beyond the field of view. Everywhere, rocks poked through a mantle of dust. To some of those watching, including Tony England, this was the most nerve-wracking moment of the mission. The crater walls plummeted steeply to a rocky floor 200 yards below, and the ground at the rim might be ready to give way at any moment. If one of the astronauts fell in, he would never get out. But the picture was deceptive, just as it had been with Scott and Irwin at Hadley Rill. The men were far from the edge. The geologists had hoped Young and Duke would be able to get close enough to the crater to see the bottom and look for exposed bedrock. Now they realized that was out of the question.
That rascally rim, it slopes toward the edge about 10 or 15 degrees, which is the kind of slope I'm standing on right now, Young explained. And then all of a sudden, in order to see to the bottom, I've got to walk another 100 yards down a 25 to 30 degree slope, and I don't think I'd better.
Before the flight, Young had talked about bringing along a 100-foot tether so that one man could venture to the rim, or even partway into the crater, while the other stayed behind to anchor him. The tether never made it onto the stowage list, not only to save weight, but because the idea made the managers too nervous. Now, without that line, Young wasn't about to let either of them get anywhere near the rim. The men backed off and spent 40 minutes taking pictures of the crater walls and collecting samples. While they worked, the TV camera panned the bright ground near the crater's eastern rim, and there, far in the distance, was a black shape.
"Good Lord," said one of the geologists. "Is that a boulder?"
Indeed it was. Mulberger could see it on his photo map, and it was dark, like the rocks on the crater floor. If Young and Duke couldn't see the bottom of North Ray, they could still bring back a piece of it, provided they got to the boulder in time. Little more than an hour was allotted for this stop. Much of it was already gone. Young and Duke had been eyeing the big boulder from the moment they arrived. Now, finally, Young said, "Okay, Charlie, let's go back to the rover. Put your bag on there and head out for the big rock." He cast his gaze toward the boulder and said with amazement,
"Look at the size of that biggie. It may be further away than we think."
"No, it's not very far," promised Duke.
But by this time, Young had had enough experience with trying to judge distance on the moon that his lunar module pilot's words didn't convince him.
"Theoretically, huh? Like everything else around here, a couple of weeks later."
The pair began to lope away from the rover, Duke leading the way. On the monitors, Young and Duke ran onward, getting smaller and smaller. It began to dawn on the geologists that this boulder was even bigger than they thought. Suddenly, from the back of the room, Jack Schmidt's voice brought an eruption of laughter. "And as our crew sinks slowly in the west..." Still Young and Duke ran. On the monitors, they were tiny. The geologists heard amazement in Duke's voice.
Look at the size of that rock.
They're not even there yet, Mahlberger said quietly. Then, at last, Young and Duke stood next to a wall of dark, rough stone. The boulder was as tall as a four-story building and twice as long.
Well, Tony, said Duke, that's your house rock right there.
House rock? Asked a voice in the back room. House rock, Mahlberger repeated quietly, like Ahab sighting the white whale. If anything was going to show what the Descartes Highlands were made of, it was house rock.
Okay, Young advised. We had to come down a pretty good slope to get to this rock, so we may have to leave early to get back.
Schmidt looked at Mahlberger. Get ready to cut other time somewhere, he said. They're going to be here a while, but there weren't going to be any extensions here. The walk-back limit was immutable.
You've got about 17 minutes before you'll have to drive off, Tony England radioed, so we'll have to hustle with this.
House rock was dark, like basalt, but it didn't take Young and Duke long to see that it wasn't basalt. It was an enormous breccia, with fragments that were more than 6 feet across. Young and Duke weren't about to say so, but here was the last nail in the coffin for the volcanic hypothesis, hammered in by a rock the size of a house. Monday, April 24th, 11:13 p.m., aboard Casper, heading back to Earth. Taken out of lunar orbit a day early, they were sure the managers were just too nervous to wait any longer to bring them home, Young, Mattingly, and Duke sped away from the moon. Like those who came before them, they recorded the unreal view with their TV camera, but the pictures went no further than mission control. Even during the moonwalks, the networks didn't broadcast for more than a couple of hours at a time. Duke's parents had to go to Mission Control's VIP room to see their son at work on the moon. At the Capcom's suggestion, they turned the camera on themselves so that their wives could get a look at them on tape when they came in the next day. When it was Young's turn to be on camera, he held a smudged hand before the lens. See that? Can you see the dirt under those fingernails? That's moon dust. You talk about two dirty people. It took us 10 minutes before we could get Ken to open the door, and we're still that way. He wasn't exaggerating. Even now, little gray pebbles drifted around the cabin and packed away in the rock boxes were a whopping 207 pounds of samples. Yep, Young told his audience. Wait till you see some of those rocks. But Mahlberger and his team couldn't wait. They were under some pressure from the media to explain the surprising findings. The nature of the Descartes was still an open question, but for the Cayley Plains, Mahlberger's team was throwing out the volcanic theory and resurrecting an older idea that went back to the cataclysmic blast that formed the Imbrium Basin. The geologist envisioned fast-moving debris surging away from the newly formed basin and across the face of the moon, reaching the Descartes Highlands, more than 600 miles away. It filled the valleys between the mountains to form the Cayley Plains. When Tony England told Young and Duke about the theory of a slosh from Imbrium and asked whether they had any response, Young tried to be diplomatic. It was too early to be saying something like that, he said. Too early to be jumping to conclusions about the geology when they hadn't even seen the rocks. He said simply, that ain't good science. The geologists would simply have to be patient. The world's only experts on the Cayley and the Descartes were on their way home, and their credentials were under their fingernails. Tuesday, April 25th, 2:43 p.m. Houston time. For Ken Mattingly, the understanding of what it means to be in space did not begin the moment he reached Earth orbit or saw his world shrink to the size of his thumb. It did not come to him in solitude above the far side of the moon. It came, instead, during the trip back to Earth, when he opened Casper's side hatch, heart pounding with excitement, and floated outside. His mission was to retrieve 2 canisters of exposed film from the side of the service module. Training for the spacewalk, he'd spent hours immersed in a water tank, clambering around in a vacuum chamber, and frantically practicing his tasks in the KC-135, a converted cargo plane that created about 0.5 minutes of weightlessness by flying in a parabolic arc. By the time Mattingly climbed into his suit aboard Casper and readied for the trip outside, He had anticipated every aspect except the experience of being in deep space. The sun was so staggeringly bright that Mattingly immediately pulled down his gold-plated outer visor. He heard the reassuring whoosh of oxygen flowing into his suit through the 50-foot umbilical. He was completely outside now. On the silver and white skin of the cylindrical service module, he saw that here and there the paint was bubbled from the heat of the maneuvering thrusters. The scientific instrument bay was near the other end of the cylinder, and he made his way there by walking with his hands along a handrail. It was effortless, just the way it had been in the zero-G airplane. Except that it wasn't like the airplane, because everywhere he looked, beyond, around, and past the service module, there was nothing at all. And he realized that this machine he was holding on to, for 9 days his universe, was a speck in the void. He squeezed the handrail so tightly that if it hadn't been for the gloves, he would say later, he would surely have left fingerprints. Arriving at the scientific instrument bay, Mattingly slid his boots into a pair of slipper-like footholds and rested. Looking back along the bright hall, he saw Charlie Duke standing in Casper's hatch, tending the umbilical. Beyond Duke, just off the nose, a full moon glowed, 50,000 miles away. When he looked to his left, he saw a tiny crescent Earth, 180,000 miles away. Looking at them through Casper's windows, he had never sensed the emptiness that lay on the other side of the glass, and in there he had seen stars. Where were all the stars? It was a three-dimensional abyss. Charlie Duke kept saying, "My God, it's dark out here," and each time Mattingly laughed, but his heart raced. Mattingly was sure the disappearance of the stars was due to his gold visor. The doctors had advised him to leave the reflector down, lest he be exposed to harmful solar radiation, but he couldn't stand it anymore. He blinked the visor open just long enough for the universe to show a familiar face. There they are! His work finished, Mattingly pulled Casper's hatch shut, and his universe became, once more, a small spacecraft drifting toward Earth. When Charlie Duke stepped off the ramp at Allington, there was NASA geologist Fred Hertz coming to greet him out of the crowd of well-wishers. Duke grinned.
"Those were sure funny-looking volcanic rocks, Fred."
"What do you think, Charlie? Are they impact rocks?"
"We leave that to you," Duke said.
Any uncertainty vanished when the samples were unpacked in the lunar receiving lab. Nearly all the rocks were breccias. The rest were ancient chunks of anorthosite. No traces of volcanic rock turned up, save for a few fragments of mare basalt thrown in by a distant impact. And while the Apollo 16 rocks could not rule out that lava or cinders had erupted elsewhere in the highlands, they all but proved that none had flowed at Descartes. It was not the first time the geologists had misinterpreted photographs of the moon. It would not be the last. But that did not mean there was anything inherently wrong with photogeology. The error, one geologist would write years later, was that they had neglected to define more than one working hypothesis. It was clear now that Elston and Boudet had been so enthusiastic about highland volcanism that they had overlooked alternative explanations. But why had so many geologists hopped onto the volcanic bandwagon? In part, they had been misled by a false assumption that had plagued them since the beginning, that the moon was somehow Earth-like. The resemblance of lunar highland formations to terrestrial volcanic features had reinforced the long-held idea that the moon had enjoyed a long and rich history of volcanic activity. In the wake of Apollo 16, geologists would come to understand that the overwhelming force that had shaped the surface of the moon was not volcanism, but the violence of cosmic bombardment. In the years to come, they would often recall a comment Ken Mattingly made from lunar orbit. Well, back to the drawing boards, or wherever geologists go. But they would also realize that Apollo 16 was perhaps the greatest leap in understanding of the moon since the first lunar landing. As one of them would later write, The mission to the Descartes Highlands illustrated once again that science advances most when its predictions prove wrong. Deciphering the evolution of the Highlands would be far more difficult than anyone had imagined, because instead of a well-defined progression of lava flows, the reality was near chaos. The origin of any particular rock or hill might be traced to a crater miles away, or perhaps a giant impact basin hundreds of miles away. 2 decades later, geologists would still be debating whether one of those impacts, the Imbrium Cataclysm, had left its imprint at Descartes. They would search the breccias for clues to the violence that had preceded Imbrium when huge asteroids struck the Moon and Earth, and in Apollo 16's collection of anorthosites, the largest of all the Apollo missions, they would be glimpses into the nature of the Moon's primordial crust. The geophysicists, too, were rewarded when, 3 weeks after Young and Duke left the Moon, Apollo 16's seismometer picked up the largest lunar impact ever recorded. Its reverberations showed that the crust at the Descartes Highlands was more than 9 miles thicker than average. And finally, Ken Mattingly's photographs and observations, combined with the data from Casper's scientific instruments, would help the scientists extend the lessons of the rocks to highland regions across the Moon. Apollo 16 did more than change the image of the Descartes Highlands. It reaffirmed the most basic reason for exploration. If they'd known so surely what was there, they wouldn't have needed to go to the Moon to begin with. The point of going was to find out. Chapter 13. The Last Men on the Moon. Apollo 17. 1. Sunrise at Midnight. Charlie Smith had seen more of the sweep of history than anyone in the United States. Born in Liberia, he'd been taken aboard a slave ship at the age of 12 and brought to Galveston, Texas, where he grew up on a white man's ranch. He'd toted a .45 since he was 13 and could tell tales of riding with Jesse James and Billy the Kid. In his adult life, he had witnessed the invention of the telephone, the automobile, the airplane, television, the atomic bomb, and the microchip. In December 1972, Charlie Smith's age was given at 130 years. As the oldest living American, he was invited to the launch of Apollo 17, and so he and his 70-year-old son, Chester, traveled from a central Florida town called Bartow to the Kennedy Space Center. As dusk fell on December 6th, they sat with dozens of other celebrities in the VIP bleachers near the Vehicle Assembly Building. Across the waters of the tidal basin, the last of the moonships gleamed in the floodlights, transformed into something mythic. The light from Pad 39A could be seen all around Brevard County, in Cocoa and O'Galley and Titusville, towns for whom the imminent departure of a team of moon voyagers had become almost commonplace. Only in the first decades of this century, when Charlie Smith was in his 70s, his 80s, had the exploration of this planet marked its last major objectives, the polar crossings, the Himalayan treks. As the scope of exploration had broadened, the pace of time had compressed. Less than 12 years had elapsed since Kennedy's decision to go to the Moon, just 4 years since Apollo 8 lifted off from Pad 39A. Now, at the same launch pad, the first age of lunar exploration would enter its last act. By now, of course, that was old news. In Houston, the Space Center was already gearing up for the Skylab flights that would begin in the spring, and beyond that was the joint mission with the Soviets, the Apollo-Soyuz test project. And then, in the late 70s, if all went according to plan, would come the Space Shuttle. It tugged at the flight controllers even as they prepared for the last moon mission. It would launch like a rocket and land like an airplane. It would withstand the fires of re-entry unscathed and be ready to fly again in a matter of weeks. It would be a technological marvel. It would be a true flying machine. It would have wings. Now was the time to move away from Apollo's throwaway lineage and make space economical. And that was the shuttle's main billing, the first reusable spacecraft. By the 1980s, NASA hoped, the shuttle would make getting to space so routine that the space program would turn a profit. It was nothing less than the future of spaceflight. Most of the astronaut office was already working on it, and other than the three men in that rocket and their backup crew, there were no veterans of lunar missions who were still working on Apollo. 11 of them had left the astronaut corps to begin life after the moon, with varying results. And then there was Deke Slayton. After 10 years, he was finally back on flight status. He'd undergone a risky procedure at the Mayo Clinic in which a catheter was inserted through his veins and into his heart so that the doctors could see once and for all whether it had been damaged, and he passed with flying colors. Literally. There was talk he might be assigned to fly on the joint Soviet-American flight in 1975, by which time he would be 51 years old. He was already studying Russian. But on the whole, it had not been a good year for astronauts. In the spring of 1972, it had come out that Dave Scott and his crew had carried 400 unauthorized first-day covers to the moon and back. The men kept 300 of the covers and gave the remaining 100 to a German stamp dealer named Horst Eiermann, with the understanding that they would be sold to collectors after the Apollo program was over, privately and with no publicity, with the three astronauts sharing equally in the profits. Each man stood to gain $8,000 by the deal, with which they planned to set up trust funds for their children. But Eiermann began selling the covers within weeks after Apollo 15 returned. Scott's crew immediately notified Eiermann that he had broken the terms of the agreement, that the deal was off. All three men refused to take any money, but word of the sales got into the European press, and it was only a matter of time before NASA found out. By the fall, there were reports that envelopes were selling for $1,500 apiece. When rumors began circulating, Deke Slayton went out on a limb to defend his people, saying he didn't believe the stories. Then Slayton found out from Jim Irwin that they were true. He was furious. Congress was demanding an investigation into improper conduct by astronauts. NASA formally reprimanded Scott and his crew. By June, Irwin had announced that he was leaving NASA and retiring from the Air Force to launch a Baptist ministry called High Flight. Al Worden was transferred to NASA's Ames Research Center near San Francisco, and Dave Scott was moved to a management post within the manned spacecraft center. The other astronauts were divided in their reactions. Some saw it as simply a dumb mistake. Others thought Scott, as crew commander, should be court-martialed. To some, it was a gray area. Astronauts had sold their autographs, for example, and profited in other, less dramatic ways from their fame. But this time, there was so much money involved, and it had all become so public. It had tarnished the astronaut corps, that it had all been done by earnest, straight-arrow Dave Scott, whose mission had been such a high point for Apollo, only made the shock greater. Years later, Scott would blame his bad judgment on the pressures of getting ready for a lunar landing mission. Whatever the astronauts thought of the stamp affair, the damage was done. Within NASA, the people who had always felt the astronaut office had too much clout were determined to see their wings clipped. For better or for worse, the myth of the perfect astronaut had crumbled. Now the public knew that astronauts didn't always follow the rules. Astronauts were fallible. They were human. By December, the stamp affair was old news. In the VIP stands, the atmosphere was something like the last performance of a long-running stage play. Some of the stars of that production, several of the men who had crossed the translunar gulf, including Jim Lovell, Neil Armstrong, and, with special irony, Dick Gordon, were on hand to see the last of their comrades leave the Earth. Nearby, more than 1,000 newspeople filled the press site, and a crowd estimated at more than 1 million people jammed the roads and beaches. All of them were lured by the promise of a space spectacular. The particulars of Apollo 17's launch window required that this be the first, and in fact the only, night launch of the Saturn V. And then there was Charlie Smith, to whom this whole thing was literally beyond belief. Wearing a Stetson and a string tie, and an Apollo 17 mission patch on his lapel, Smith gazed at the Saturn and said in a sly but paper-thin voice,
"I see that's a rocket, but there ain't nobody going to no moon, me, you, or anybody else."
And for a while that night it seemed that the old man was right. As the launch time of 9:53 p.m. approached, lightning danced among distant purple clouds, seemingly ready to threaten the launch but never doing so. Behind the party din of conversation, the loudspeakers carried the voice of the public information officer, Jack King, his flat monotone counting down the last hours and minutes. Vapor issued from the Saturn, its stages filling with super-cold propellants. Now the crowd quieted, and the voice on the loudspeakers fully emerged, echoing in the calm, damp night, counting down, now 5 minutes to go, now one. Then, at 30 seconds, the steady cadence of numbers halted. "We have a cutoff," said the voice. "We have a cutoff." 3.5 miles away, at the pinnacle of the rocket, Gene Cernan, Ron Evans, and Jack Schmidt waited tensely inside the command module America, all thoughts on the abort handle in Cernan's left hand. No other moment could have totally crystallized the responsibility that went along with command of a spacecraft and a $450 million lunar mission. Cernan had trained for Apollo 17 as the climax of his career. He was not going to be denied. If the Saturn's guidance system went out during the launch, he was prepared to fly it into orbit himself, using the 8-ball, the hand controller, and the stars. But let this machine get off the ground. Don't make Apollo 17 end with a twist of the abort handle. There was no danger. The launch pad's automatic sequencer, which controlled each split-second event in the complex launch sequence, had failed to pressurize the Saturn's third stage. In the blockhouse, 3.5 miles away, the launch controllers noticed the problem and sent the necessary command directly to the booster. But they were too late. The sequencer, aware of its own error, didn't accept their action as a substitute. It stopped the count on its own. For a time, it seemed depressingly likely to Cernan and his crew that they would not launch that night. But soon there was welcome news. The launch teams would work around the malfunction. It would take a couple of hours. During the delay, Evans fell asleep, and Cernan and Schmidt got on the air to complain about the snoring. Far from the crowds and the VIPs, at the special viewing site reserved for astronauts, their families and friends, Jan Evans waited tensely with her children, John and Jamie. Barbara Cernan and her daughter Tracy were here too. All day Jan had been going on pure excitement. It had to be that way after all those parties, like the bash thrown by Life magazine, and the other celebrations that had been in full swing for days. The tension she felt now was not out of fear. Jan had too much faith in the hardware for that. It was out of the desire to see her husband do what he had longed to for the past 6 years. From this same grassy shore, she and Ron had watched most of the moon flights begin. They had heard thunder and shed tears out of elation for their departing friends, and Ron had always said, "One day that's going to be me." Jan was as devoted to her husband as any astronaut wife. In 1965, when she and Ron had a house near Miramar Naval Air Station in San Diego, a letter arrived informing him that he had the qualifications to apply for the 5th group of astronauts and asking whether he wished to volunteer. At that moment, Ron was 8,000 miles away, flying sorties from the USS Ticonderoga off the coast of North Vietnam. The letter said all applications must be in within 10 days. Jan sprang into action. She worked up her courage and called Deke Slayton herself and told him, "Ron definitely volunteers." Slayton assured her they'd accept his application late. Many months later, after he had gone home for the physicals and the interviews, and then rejoined his ship, Evans returned from a mission and got the message to report to the ready room. Wondering what he had done wrong, Evans arrived to find the captain and several of the other pilots gathered, and the captain read the letter informing Ron that he had been selected as an astronaut. His shipmates would say later, he just about floated out of his chair. Hours ago, just before nightfall, Jan and the children had waited at the entrance to the crew quarters to say goodbye to Ron. First came Jean Cernan, emerging into the glare of the television lights and blowing a kiss to 9-year-old Tracy. Ron was right behind him, grinning, giving a little skip as he came out like a kid. For a moment he stopped, and she put an arm around the bulk of his white spacesuit and planted a kiss on the clear bubble helmet and watched him climb into the transfer van, followed by Jack Schmidt. Then the van headed off into the night. Now, for Jan Evans, there was only waiting. It was past midnight now. Just as the delay seemed interminable, the count entered its final minutes, heading for a launch time of 12:33 a.m. Once more the voice on the loudspeaker counted down, and this time it did not stop. At the 8-second mark, there was an explosion of red flame underneath the Saturn that gave way to a river of incandescent white. The sight of it drew from the crowd one great, "Ah!" as twin plumes of fire and yellow smoke issued into the dark sky on either side of the launch tower. At the moment of release, as the great rocket rose from the earth, the sky filled with a brilliant golden light, like the light of sunrise. As the crowd cheered, the announcer's voice, suddenly electric, was heard. "It's lighting up the sky. It's just like daylight here at the Kennedy Space Center." Then the noise hit. Up to now, no one had been aware of the eerie silence as the shock waves rolled across the tidal basin, arriving at the viewing sites just as the Saturn cleared the launch tower. It was a rippling, ear-splitting staccato roar that pummeled the chests of the surprised spectators and shook the ground. It rattled houses all up and down the Cape. Far beyond, the glow from this second sun was visible across Florida and as far away as North Carolina. Jan Evans stood transfixed by the rocket carrying her husband, never taking her eyes off it, not even when she was suddenly aware of a great commotion in the water in front of her. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw fish jumping into the golden light, so many that the water seemed to boil with their thrashing until, at last, the sonic wave crested. The rocket was now a glowing torch suspended high overhead, its flame fanning out in the rarefied air at the outer reaches of the atmosphere. Now there was stillness again. She could hear Jean Cernan's voice, charged with adrenaline, echoing from the loudspeaker in curt exchanges with Houston. When the first stage fell away, there was a sudden, brilliant flash. A moment later, the escape tower departed, and she heard a cry of delight from Ron. "Aha! There she goes!" But that was all. From now on, she heard only the clipped technical jargon of the mission. She did not cry. Not this time. She was possessed of a wonderful, joyous calm. As she watched her husband's rocket dwindle to a bright star, she felt that a part of her was going with him to share the adventure for which he had worked so long. He was way out over the Atlantic now, hundreds of miles away from her already. She strained to follow Apollo 17 into the night with her eyes, but before it reached orbit, it was gone. Meanwhile, at the VIP bleachers, Charlie Smith, who had watched this extraordinary leaving with a steady gaze, said,
"I see they're going somewhere, but that don't mean nothing."
9 years of a man's life can go by in a flash. At least it sometimes seemed that way to Jean Cernan. In 1963, the year he and Barbara went to Houston, he couldn't believe he had been chosen over so many pilots with test pilot credentials. Their daughter, Tracy, was born. When he flew Gemini 9, she was only 3. She didn't understand what was happening. By the time he went to the moon on Apollo 10, she was 6, old enough for him to take her outside one night a month before launch and try to explain things. The moon was very far away, where God is, and hardly anybody had ever been there, but he and Mr. Stafford and Mr. Young were going there. And when he came back, he took Tracy out under the moon once more, and she said,
"Daddy, you went to the moon, and the moon is way far away where God is, and you went with Mr. Stafford and Mr. Young, and hardly anybody else has ever been there."
Then she got quiet for a moment, and Cernan figured she was about to plumb the depths of 6-year-old curiosity, and that his answer would be the makings of tomorrow's show-and-tell. What he forgot was that for a little girl whose next-door neighbors were astronauts, going to the moon wasn't a very big deal.
Daddy?
What, punk?
Now that you've been to the moon, when are you going to take me camping like you promised?
Tracy Cernan was 9 now, and she understood very well that her daddy was going back to the moon, and that this time he was going to walk on it. Probably, though, she didn't realize how much it meant that he was returning as a mission commander. That was even more important to Cernan than crossing the last 50,000 feet he had missed on Apollo 10. It was so important, in fact, that Cernan had actually turned down a chance to walk on the moon as John Young's lunar module pilot. It had been a calculated gamble. Slayton had not promised him another flight after Apollo 10, and even after he was assigned to back up 14, there was absolutely no guarantee that he and his crew would get their own flight. But in August 1971, his gamble had paid off. And if command was the greatest challenge he had faced in his career, then Cernan had grown into it. During his first two flights, Gemini 9 and Apollo 10, Cernan had been Tom Stafford's shadow. Though he treated his crew like equals, Stafford was a natural leader and a strong commander who knew how to use his power. Cernan had learned much simply by being around him, and looking back on Apollo 10, he'd come to realize how little he knew then about his spacecraft when he thought he had known so much. Now, at age 38, Cernan had matured into a seasoned astronaut. In a sense, he was an amalgam of the broad spectrum of personalities in the astronaut office. Like most of his colleagues, his ego was among the healthiest in the country, but those who met him were always pleased to find him just a regular guy. Cernan was one of the astronauts whom people who worked at the Space Center liked to introduce to their friends. Here was this charismatic 6-foot figure with cool blue eyes, salt and pepper hair, and quiet poise. Like a good PR man, Cernan could make a stranger feel immediately comfortable. He seemed at once to savor the hero's mantle and to disown it. To be sure, he enjoyed the social perks that went along with the job. He made the Houston party scene with as much enthusiasm as Wally Schirra and Jim Lovell ever had. Richard Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, played golf with him and dined at his home. He and Barbara had the aura of a storybook couple. If Cernan had stayed in the Navy, his goal would have been to be a squadron commander, and with the Apollo 14 backup crew, he had his squadron. It even had the squadron spirit. What other team had come up with its own backup patch? They were what Ron Evans called a crew. They flew together, they played together, and they would have gone to the moon together had it not been for the cancellation of Apollo 18. Cernan had seen that coming. He understood that NASA would have been foolish to have a geologist available for the last landing and not send him, especially considering the storm of criticism that would have unleashed. Still, Joe Engel was his friend and his crewman, and Cernan had fought to keep him on all the way to NASA headquarters, but it had come down to an ultimatum: accept the change or lose the mission. And in that episode, Cernan had learned the limits of the spacecraft commander's power. Now that was ancient history. Cernan would be the first to acknowledge that Schmidt had earned his seat. He knew that many of the old heads thought putting a scientist on a lunar mission was too risky, that NASA had caved into pressure from the scientific community, and that it was a mistake. Cernan didn't agree. Schmidt was not the greatest aviator the world had ever seen, but certainly adequate, and during the flight he wouldn't do any flying anyway. More important, he was a damn good lunar module pilot. His geologic expertise, of course, was unquestioned. As to whether Schmidt would really be able to use that expertise on the moon, working to the timeline and encased in a pressurized spacesuit, that was something Cernan and many astronauts wondered about. But he was certain of one thing. He and Schmidt would stay on the moon the longest, collect the most rocks, take the most photographs, bring home the most data. That would make the last the best. NASA's managers did not seem to share his spirit. To them, Apollo 17 was like a last-minute all-or-nothing bet at the blackjack table, because if Cernan and his crew didn't come back from the moon, the shuttle and the rest of the space program would be in jeopardy. Some confided to Cernan If it were up to me, I'd cancel this flight. Even Chris Kraft, who had succeeded Bob Gilruth as director of the manned spacecraft center, was telling him, "Take off your white scarf. We don't want to lose anyone now. Don't take any chances out there. Just get home alive." Understandable, though, it was. This kind of talk rankled Cernan. He sensed, as Neil Armstrong had in the months before Apollo 11, the damage that failure would cause the program and the national image. And as a mission commander, he was already conservative. He didn't need to hear Kraft telling him not to take unnecessary risks. Whatever the mood in Houston, Cernan was concerned that elsewhere, Apollo's imminent end was hurting morale. It was true that at the Cape, where technicians readied his Saturn V for launch, the biggest job cuts were long past, but 900 more workers were due to be laid off after the mission. In Downey, California, the Rockwell teams were at work on command modules for the Skylab missions and the joint Soviet-American flight, but on Long Island, the Grumman people were literally working themselves out of a job. The entire lunar module program would be over when Apollo 17 left the moon. Cernan and Schmidt spent a lot of time at Grumman, and if morale was bad, they never saw it. It amazed Cernan how they worked as hard, if not harder, on the final lander. Maybe he and Schmidt had something to do with that. At the Cape and in Houston, Cernan's crew organized softball games with flight controllers and support teams. They threw parties. Years later, those who were involved would remember this Apollo crew for those times. They would also remember that Cernan, who had never been shy about public speaking, was in his element. Sometimes, after a few drinks, and sometimes not even after a few drinks, he would stand up on a chair and launch into an oration that was part pep talk and part campaign speech. "Apollo 17 may be the last flight to the moon," Cernan would say, "but it's not the end, it's the end of the beginning." And for the most part, it worked, though some of his audience smiled to themselves at this mixture of ham and sincerity. Later they teased, "Gene, I'm not sure I've got it straight. Is it the end or the beginning?" Whatever you called it, Apollo 17 was the last roll of the dice for the geologists. Only one chance remained to unravel the knotted ball of string called lunar evolution. Before the flight, when the press queried him on the value of yet another moon mission, Jack Schmidt liked to say that the moon had as much land area as the entire continent of Africa, and yet astronauts had explored only a handful of acres. How could anyone think that an entire world might give up its secrets after only a half dozen modest expeditions? Obviously, the choice of landing site for Apollo 17 was especially consequential, and when he was named to that mission, Jack Schmidt had resurrected his goal of landing on the far side, on the dark lava floor of the crater Tsiolkovsky. It was a dream site, with not only a far side mare to sample — would it differ chemically from those on the near side? — but a gigantic central peak that offered samples from deep within the far side crust. Needless to say, Schmidt didn't need to sell the idea to the geologists, but when he talked it up to his flight controller friends, they half-jokingly responded, "Well, Jack, out of sight, out of mind." There would be no Earth in the sky above Tsiolkovsky, and the only way to communicate would be via special relay satellites in lunar orbit. A pair of Tyros weather satellites were already available as off-the-shelf spacecraft. A single Titan booster could place both of them at a point about 30,000 miles above the far side, one of the so-called libration points, where gravitational conditions were such that they would remain suspended over the surface within sight of both Tsiolkovsky and Earth. Schmidt had first raised the idea late in the spring of 1970 as part of an effort to save Apollo 18 and 19. If he could show that those missions could